Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, welcome back to Camp Half Pod. We are your head counselors. I'm Erin, daughter of Athena.
And I'm Monica, daughter of Persephone. Today we're recapping and discussing episode 7 of the Percy Jackson Disney Plus show.
Today are gonna talk about episode 7, which is really wild that there's only 2 episodes left, and this was a good one. I'm excited.
It was really good. It was really fun to see the underworld. Mm-hmm. I loved the concept of the inverted castle where they walk into it. It's like, it looks like the Do you know rocks? What is the thing that grows?
Do I know rocks?
Do you know rocks personally, spiritually?
Dwayne the Rock Johnson? Yeah, I know him.
Personally?
Yeah, personally.
Some kind of knight, right? Sam's the knight? No, that's the company.
Like, you know, the granite?
But the rock formations in caves where it grows like from the ceiling, like an icicle.
Like a stalactite?
Yeah, I see, you know rocks.
Yeah, stalagmites, stalactites, and columns. I googled rock formation in caves.
Well, that's the concept of the castle, where it's like, because it's the underworld, it's growing, almost feeding from the world above it to grow this like inverted looking castle with a bridge that connects it. And I thought that was so clever. It's not what I would ever pictured for Hades' palace.
Same, but I really love it. That's a change that I'm like, that is not at all what I pictured, but I really like that. And I think that's really unique. I haven't seen that done before in depictions of the underworld.
It matches the underworld tone of being kind of cold and Hades, especially Pluto is like the god of stones and rocks or whatever.
Yeah, he's a rock guy.
He's a rock guy. And so it makes sense that his palace would look kind of like a rock. I imagine, I know people are thinking like Poseidon's palace will look very similar to Triton's palace in Little Mermaid.
Yeah,
or like Atlantis, but I am picturing almost like a sand castle or even just like a coral, something made out of coral, like to be on theme, to look like it grows naturally within the environment that these gods thrive in.
Yeah, I like that. I like that it looks like it's growing from the top of a cave. It's really cool.
We have some things to talk about in this episode because there were some parts that I really loved, some parts that I don't really know was necessary. So I'm curious to hear what you have to think about it.
Yeah.
I overall really loved this episode. There was a lot of really great flashbacks.
Yes. That
it really built more on Percy's background and Poseidon and Sally in general too.
Yeah, I loved getting to see that. I think it'll be interesting because, I mean, I feel very, very grateful to have had all these episodes in advance and be able to watch them or so back to back. I know in real time when we're recording this, episode 6 recently came out, and I've seen a lot of people being like, why are there 4 pearls instead of 3? Which I guess wasn't first, I wasn't that concerned about it. I don't know. It wasn't a detail that I really latched onto. And then I was able to watch the next one within a few days of watching the 6th one and see that they like resolved that issue pretty quickly in this episode. And so hopefully people will be like, oh, okay, after seeing this one, because I think it still gets to the point of Percy having to make a decision to not save his mom later in the episode. So,
well, the whole point of the 4 versus 3 is that we know in the books, Percy doesn't tell them that he's trying to save his mom. That's not his supposed to be his goal. He's not supposed to do that. So he's given three and has a secret desire to save his mom. In this one, he's like, I am going to the underworld to save my mom. And that is like the number one thing. And so everyone is on board with that. So it would be crazy to only give him three. Then if they only gave him three, you know that Grover or Annabeth would have stayed behind from the underworld. So that Percy would have had a chance to go down there and get his mom. So that's in order to build the story and so that all like three of them get to go down there and then Percy has to make a decision, you have to start with four pearls.
Yeah. And I think it's a good way as well to set up Poseidon. I mean, it's very nuanced in the sense that Poseidon didn't show up to the meeting with Percy, but he did give him the fourth pearl for his mom. So we're kind of playing with this idea of Percy. He starts with an immense distrust toward the gods, and then he gains trust when he does the whole jumping off the arch thing. And I think if they had only given him three pearls, this version of Percy would have just been like, fuck you, where's my fourth one? I need to save my mom. Because he's very open, like you said, about that. That is his goal for this quest. He does not really care about the rest. Though he's kind of forced to in this one, which is really neat to see. He's forced to kind of come into that hero role and want to finish the quest simply because it's the right thing to do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. So this episode covers chapters 18 and 19 in the Percy Jackson books. And it's our episode 7 and a bit of 8. So if you want to re-listen to that, that's a good way to refresh on what happened in the book. Obviously, we're going to be doing a compare and contrast, so this will be fun.
Yeah. Sweet.
All right, so our episode summary. Our heroes journey across the underworld and bargain for their safety with the god of the dead.
Dun, dun, dun.
I'm excited to talk about Hades because he's not what I thought he would be at all, and he's not what he's like in the books.
I liked this take on Hades, but I agree. It was different than what I was expecting. But we'll get into it. I think it was fun. It was interesting. Okay. So the show does open immediately with a scene of Krusty's waterbed shop, which is really fun that we got that detail in the show. They definitely did it really differently, and the scene's a lot quicker in the show. But this is a great nod to the books and to a lot of the locations in the books that were important.
I was a little confused on why they kept this part in the show, but then they didn't show a zebra or have Percy talk to a zebra in an episode that, like, we take a zebra to Vegas. It's titled that, and that they didn't have him interact with the zebra. And then, but they remembered to about Krusty's. That's very interesting.
Well, Krusty's extremely important, actually. Like, such a major character. So important to the plot. Yeah, that's a good point. It is an interesting one that isn't really relevant to the plot. Krusty does not make a comeback to our disappointment later on in the books. He's not an important recurring character. But it does feel like they wanted to keep that element of the book and keep a lot of the locations in the book and not cut this one out.
So, and this is also different because in the books, they walk into the waterbed and they just don't know what's going on. And also Percy uses his powers of the waterbed to trap Krusty's. I think there was a plot hole where Krusty's or Procustus is Poseidon's son. So he is able to, so that was a little bit of a misstep on Rick's part in the book, but in this one they corrected it by having it not be Percy who pushes him down, but Annabeth. So Percy enters Krusty's waterbed emporium. He already knows that there's the entrance of the underworld there. He's like, I want to get in. I know you are the, you know, killer of travelers. We're not going to fall for your MLM, essentially, of selling waterbed.
Yes. Like, who buys a waterbed anymore?
Yeah. That's like, no, waterbeds were never a good idea. I don't know why.
No. They weren't. You're just going to feel like they're going to break. You're going to feel like you peed yourself. Are they even that good for your back? I don't know.
I doubt it. And I also, like, if I wanted to feel the sensation of being on a boat, I would be on a boat. Like, there's a reason. Yeah. Or I'd get drunk. Like, you know, there's a reason that we want firm mattresses.
Imagine getting into a waterbed drunk.
Oh my god. Oh. I'd be swimming. I'd be like fighting for my life down there. I know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Percy is a bit freaked out by the fact that this man is his half-brother. Like, this is an old man, too, which is very interesting. But, like, this guy is a representation of Percy's family that he has not met yet. And he's just like, can I get by? Like, I don't want to buy a waterbed. And Krusty's like, I will sell this waterbed whether it kills me or not. Mm-hmm. So,
and it does kill him.
It does kill him. I mean, we assume he's still alive because he's still shouting at Annabeth. Later.
True. He's not killed. Yeah.
But an invisible Annabeth pushes Krusty into a waterbed, which wraps and holds him there instead of stretching him out, which is like a very intense and brutal way to torture and kill someone. So I think they just were like, he's going to get a nice little hug instead.
Yeah. He's just going to be trapped in a little bed and it's fine. Just a little tight. So then we get a flashback scene of Percy in the car. And this is what we saw a moment of when Hermes touched Percy in the last episode, when they were sitting at that table in like a little food area or alcove of the casino. And we saw baby Percy sitting in the car. So we actually get to see what happens in this scene. And I really loved this, I hyperfixated on this, where they park and we see Sally in the front and she quotes to Percy, she says, we're not in Kansas anymore, which Percy is kind of like, I don't know what that means. And that ends up being something they come back to later in this episode, that Percy quotes that and Annabeth is like, I don't know what that means. Well, anyway, and then Sally is like, oh, I haven't shown you that one. And from later in the episode, when Percy quotes it, clearly she eventually did show him that movie. And in episode 5, Annabeth was like, I haven't seen any movies. And Percy was like, I promised to show them to you. And I was just thinking so much about how, like, so much of Sally is in Percy, like this, how he wants to show her the movies and like, invite her into the things he's quoting, and I find it really cute.
Well, Percy's like, the ultimate love is Sally and how she shows love to me, and he's replicating that and like, I will take Annabeth to a movie, I'll show her the things that I like, and the way that he talks to Grover is very similar to the way that Sally talked to Grover. It's just like very like reflective of parenting in Percy, which I think is really cool.
And important, too, because in this flashback, we see that Sally is not having a great parenting moment. She's really frustrated. Where they're parked is at a new school for Percy, and she's trying to get Percy into this school, and he's being difficult. He doesn't want to get out of the car. He doesn't want to leave. And Sally has to snap at him a bit and threaten to like forcibly remove him from the car unless he goes with her.
I had a moment, and this was like later when we see more of this flashback, where I remember the fact that Sally had Percy at like 19, right? In the books. And so Percy can't be more than like 7, right?
Yeah, maybe 8. I don't know.
So I'm like, Sally is like around our age at this point. Oh. And she has this kid who is a demigod that she is trying to protect and trying to save. And the system is against him. The god, like both systems, Olympus and also just like our normal capitalism system where she doesn't have enough money. She can't take care of him. He's a special needs kid. It's like there's so many things that is out of her control. And the fact that that is like, this is the most that she snaps at him and he's like remembering it deeply is so interesting. Cause I was like thinking the moment that baby Percy locks the car and Sally like basically has like a very stern conversation of like, it's gonna happen. It's whether you want to make this moment of saying goodbye really tough or not. And my reaction would have been to lunge to the other side and drag him by his hair. Like, you know, it's just like the patience that she has. And I think most parents have, it's like learned obviously as you raise something that you love, but I was like, damn, like I was really feeling for her in this moment.
I really feel for her. I think she has been so far my favorite part of this adaptation, is the way that they're giving us even more of the Percy Sally relationship.
So something we forgot to mention is right before they enter the underworld, Percy hands out his pearls to each one of his friends. He's like, it doesn't feel comfortable hoarding all the pearls in case they get split up and need an escape route. He's like, this is also a showing of how much he trusts them now. Like,
yeah,
he doesn't need it for himself. He's like, I got mine and my mom's and you guys will take care of each other. I know you won't just like abandon me. I know that you will see this through. So they're also not super into taking them from him. They're like, those are a gift from your dad. And he's like, if I get eaten, then you guys are stuck in the underworld. So let's just make sure our chance. It's logical. It's very Annabeth of him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's rubbing off on him, I guess. Yeah. And I also love this moment when they're like standing before the entrance to the underworld and talking about how it kind of smells like rotting things. And Grover's really nervous. And so Annabeth just happens to have like a squeaky ball that she gives him for his anxiety, which I thought was a very funny detail. We know it comes back to serve a purpose shortly. But you just hear Grover squeaking it throughout the scene, which is very funny to me. And also alerted my dogs during this scene.
That's so funny.
They were like, oh.
Ball? They get into the underworld. And this part of the underworld is super dark, huge gate. And it's like, gave me Mordor vibes of like the giant gates at Mordor with the in the Lord of the Rings. Where they're just like, how do we sneak past Charon and get into the entrance instead of sneaking past? They push their way through. It's just like saying excuse me but also lying, and they're like, oh, we have people in the front there, and it's like squeezing by. And like at one point, I don't know which one of the three says it, but they're like, this is hell, like this is awful, like this is the worst thing they could do, is like pushing through. It feels really wrong to push past all these people.
Yeah, and then Percy's like, you need to come with me to New York. I think Grover says it, and Percy says something. Like, Percy's just like, I don't care about pushing these people out of the way. I got places to be. They can wait. They're already dead. He does say excuse me, though, every time. He's a polite boy, at least.
Yeah, at least there's that.
Yeah.
In the books, they're able to bribe Charon, who notices immediately that they're not dead, but is also kind of like, we'll take money. This one, unfortunately, notices they're not dead, and not even money can sway him. He calls our boy Cerberus, who's our huge Rottweiler, and he ends up charging them. They start running before they even see the Rottweiler because they hear the noise, and they understand. At this point, they've been chased by enough monsters to know that they need to start running now.
Yeah, they're like, we are out of here. Does the Rottweiler, does he like just trample all the people in line that are in the way? Like,
yeah, but they're dead. So I'm sure that they're just like, yeah, either he tramples them or they just like their spirits go through his body, something like that.
Ooh, very ghosty. So then we get a sequence of them running from Cerberus. The puppy, call it the puppy, chases them along the wall and then straight up eats Grover.
I was shocked.
I was shocked. And I will say one note on this, and this is perhaps because I'm watching it on a computer, because with the screeners, they only work with Apple TVs, and I do not have an Apple TV. So I'm watching on my computer. It was so dark, I couldn't see what was happening. This is a problem in all of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Stop making everything so dark. It was dark. And I was also watching it during the day. I had to like shut all the blinds because I was like, what's happening? I barely noticed that Grover got eaten. I had to rewind. Because when he was like spit up, I was like, wait, what did Grover get in there?
Cerberus is chasing Annabeth and Percy, and they have to split up. And Percy's like, all right, I gotta stand my ground. There's nowhere to go. He pulls out Riptide, and Cerberus instead flops over because Annabeth has managed to climb up on the doggy and found the exact point to scratch him where he's just so cozy. It's very Rottweiler. I can't remember if we put it in an earlier episode when they're talking about the creation of Cerberus and the fact they had to choose a Rottweiler because all other dogs that they modeled didn't have the behaviors that they were looking for and was described in the book. So Cerberus had to be a Rottweiler, and I loved that so much as somebody who loves Rottweilers and grew up with them.
That's so great. I love that. It's so cute. Well, Annabeth pets Cerberus. He does spit out Grover. And then Grover runs over to Percy, and Grover uses his magic shoes to fly Percy to the top of the wall of the entrance, and Annabeth keeps scratching Cerberus.
Grover's about to fly down to get her again, but she's the smart girly, and so she uses the ball to get Cerberus to jump, uses Cerberus to jump herself up to the wall, and then throws the ball into the river so that Cerberus is just chasing after it.
Yeah. And they have this moment, this little shot where Annabeth is hanging from the cliff and Percy helps her up. And it is such an interesting call forward, foreshadowing to Tartarus and what we know will happen in Heroes of Olympus.
Dun, dun, dun.
I know. So after she throws the ball, Annabeth looks really sad, and we overhear in the background, because Percy's kind of focused in the front of the camera, but we overhear her telling Grover in the background about how she used to have a dog when she lived with her dad. It made me excited to see Annabeth one day interact with Mrs. O'Leary if we get that season 2 renewal. And I thought this also spoke to that continued theme of who is a monster and who isn't, because this is a dog that looks like a monster but actually just wants to play fetch. And I love that it's also a Rottweiler, because this is a breed that's often seen as vicious and labeled, but like, I've never met a mean Rottweiler before. And so speaks to that continued theme of like, what is a monster? What do we classify as monsters? Or are the monsters just the humans? Or in this case, the gods who appear very, very human in this series, but are kind of the worst of them all.
On the wall, Grover realizes that our buddy boy, Cerberus, has eaten his pearl when he got chewed up over there. And they don't really have time to decide what to do, because they see the upside down castle of Hades, and they are on a deadline that is actually already passed, but they gotta move.
They're not really on a deadline anymore. No. They could really take their time. They're on vacation under there. I've seen a lot of people talking about that change as a problem. And admittedly, it had been, 3 years since I'd read the first book, since we did it on this podcast. So when I watched it, I was like, did they miss the deadline in the books? I don't remember. So I understand that some people are confused by that change and upset. I did see a tweet, of course, because, everyone's a critic on Twitter, but I thought this was a good tweet, of someone saying that it sets Percy up as an even clearer foil to Luke, because Luke also failed his quest, and technically now Percy has failed. He did not complete it by the deadline, but the things they decide to do after they quote-unquote fail the quest are what's important.
Ooh, I love that.
Right? It's a good take. Good takes on Twitter. It's shocking. It's shocking. So then we get another flashback to Percy being not admitted to the school that Sally's driven him to. So there's the headmaster sitting across the counter from Sally, and Percy is sitting off to the side by himself, clearly overhearing this whole conversation. And he's telling Sally that they are not allowing Percy entry to this school because the previous school's counselor called to let him know that Percy had drawn a Pegasus and then was caught on the roof of the school searching for a Pegasus, which is very dangerous. And he points to how the school isn't equipped for this kind of like psychological case, the mental health. I think it's an interesting angle that they're making Percy less of a troublemaker like he was in the books and constantly being kicked out for, lighting the school on fire. And it's more so that he's troubled. I find it a lot sadder to watch.
Yeah, it makes the isolation more interesting, because when he's like a troublemaker, which, in that case, it's like a lot of blame on him of like not controlling himself. In this one, it's like everyone around him kind of feels bad for him because he's clearly troubled and it's out of his control. But then again, they do nothing to help. So it's still isolating and it's a different kind of sad.
Yeah, they just say, we can't deal with this kind of a child at our school, instead of setting him up with resources.
So Sally won't take no for an answer, which I thought was very brave of her. Like, she's like, this is not going to work. Like, that is a bullshit excuse, and you know it. And I'm not leaving here until you give me entrance into the school for my son. And the headmaster kind of suggests homeschooling. He's like, maybe a kid who is troubled like this needs to be closer to a parent, which is, first of all, super shitty to, like, set that up to a parent. Mm-hmm. Sally's a single mom who has to work. Like, that's not going to be something that's reasonable or expected. And headmaster is, like, steamrolling with this idea of, like, we'll give you resources. And it sets up Percy to believe that Sally's trying to get rid of him. Like, she would rather enroll him in a school far away than take this opportunity. Like, he perks up when he hears the idea of homeschooling because all he wants to be is close to his mom. And his mom's not letting that happen.
Yeah, because that sounds like a good time to Percy. His mom's the only person who ever believes any of the things he says he sees, that he experiences. He's like, why would that be so bad to spend more time with you, to not have to go to school? And he hears her immediately reject it and not even give it a moment's consideration.
And there's layers to it. Like, a regular, if Percy was a regular child, that's still implausible. Like, Sally is being a single mom, having to work for a living and not probably being at home. And then there's the added layer. If Sally keeps Percy at home and, like, makes it work, the monsters are going to find him. He's in the middle of New York City. Yeah. He's attracting a lot of attention. She's trying to keep him safe by taking him to more remote places where it's less likely a monster will encounter him. And he's surrounded by other children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Percy knows none of this, so he's just betrayed in this moment.
So sad.
And then, speaking of betrayal, we're going. The next scene is trudging through the fields of Asphodel, which was creepy as hell.
So creepy. Those guys. I guess they're humans. I'm like, those little things. They're human beings, but they looked so creepy, standing there, totally still. With the all gray, ominous tree background.
They have no hair, no eyelashes, eyebrows. They're just kind of reminiscent, like almost like a, the beginning of a drawing of a human before you start adding things to them. Because they've been stripped away of everything. They're rooted to the ground. They don't have, I don't know if they don't have feet anymore or if their feet are completely covered by roots. And they're wearing, like, I love how they're all wearing, like, a little bit of a dress. So they're, like, hiding the roots.
Do they have to get, like, outfitted to go to Asphodel? You know, like, when they check in with Charon, he's like, okay, we have to put you in the uniform. What size are you?
I'm going to shave your head, put you in the uniform, and put you over here. It's like jail. Yeah, demeaning.
Yeah. I found, after seeing this, I did some Googling on Asphodel because I was wondering if this is a certain interpretation. And granted, my Googling was brief. I am not a scholar. But this is, because this is a really different interpretation than the books. In the books, it was just where normal people go, people who weren't heroes but also weren't terrible people. And they just mill around in the gray, which... From my really intense Googling, this is also the typical interpretation where the majority of normal people go. There are different interpretations of if Asphodel is like a positive connotation or negative. I know I was reading that there was a period of time where it was portrayed as a more negative thing when they were trying to increase propaganda to join the military and fight. Because the idea of you only go to Elysium if you fight in a war and die a hero was very prominent.
Ooh, that's so interesting.
Right? Isn't that interesting? But I couldn't find anything about an interpretation of Asphodel being just where people who are rooted to the ground for regret are. That may be out there. I only looked on Wikipedia. I do not I'm not a scholar. That is not the angle that we bring here at Camp HuffPod. We bring a Googling to the forefront. But yeah, I thought it had really interesting implications for the fact if we're still considering Asphodel the place where most normal people go, is that implying that most normal people are rooted by some form of regret? And it also has interesting implications for in Heroes of Olympus, Hazel's character, since it's established. And I don't really know that this is a big spoiler because this is revealed about her character in like one of her first chapters, that she spent time in Asphodel and was stuck there for a bit. Like, was she rooted by regret?
Well, her regret, yeah. I'm sure it was. Yeah.
But she definitely had things to regret.
Yes.
Not her fault, but.
Yeah. Well, that's it's like the things they did in life or they did not do. So I thought that interpretation was really interesting because everyone has like things that they wish they had done, but is it enough to root them in Asphodel?
Yeah.
So the trio ends up hearing Cerberus as they're walking through Asphodel and they're like, okay, he's coming. He's the patrol dog. We got to move. But Annabeth ends up finding herself rooted. She has some kind of regret that has latched her into place. This is an interesting change that they did in the book because they separate Percy, Annabeth, and Grover. And also, I have no idea what has rooted her in place.
Yeah, I was really trying to think about it. I don't hate this change, but I like, as someone who has read the books multiple times, has read the following series, I was like, what is it? Is it leaving home and running away? Because we know from the books that that's something that she wanted to go back to and like rekindle her relationship with her dad. Is that what they're playing at? Or is there something else that they're adding lore to that happened that we don't know about yet?
Maybe it's Talia. Like, that has been such a theme. I wonder if it's like the fact that she and Luke didn't, like, went into camp and Talia stayed behind to fight.
Yeah. Like, then, survivor's guilt.
Crazy that Grover doesn't get rooted because he has so much regret when it comes to Talia being there.
Yeah. Because that's like he was her protector. Because that was one of his biggest things and one of his biggest fears in being on this quest with Percy and being Percy's protector is of the same thing happening again and not being able to save the hero. That's a good point. Why the heck was Grover? He's like, I've moved on. Like, Annabeth goes and talks to Talia's tree every day. Grover, he's like, I'm moved over on. It. You know, I didn't really know her that well.
I have a new demigod now and I've done better. He's alive, so we're good.
He's replaced his friend. Also, I realized we forgot to mention as well, just before this, they're having a conversation about how Grover's like, I'm going to stay behind because I was the one who lost the pearl. And Percy is just refusing to accept that, saying he'll stay behind. So they're already thinking about who's going to end up being the one who sacrificed.
I also thought the reason that Annabeth was rooted is probably for plot device of making you, especially someone who has not read the books, wonder if Annabeth is the one who's betrayed Percy. Because they've kind of set her up in this moment. Like, we expecting that either Grover or Annabeth is going to betray him. So this is a great way. Annabeth has completely been Percy's perfect companion up until this point. Like, they had their, after the Medusa episode, they have been working really well together. They've built a lot of trust. So to have this little, like, sliver of doubt about her character and about her relationship with Percy, I think is powerful. I don't know if it was necessary. I think
I agree.
Could have moved on without it, but it was a plot device to make it different than the book. So that way we who know the story kind of get confused too.
Yeah, exactly. And I really hope it's something that they'll come back to and answer that question of what was that regret, whether that is in the final episode or in another season, if we get it. Because it feels like a really important thing to plant and a big change from the books to not address it later. So I really hope that it is something that will be addressed later.
Yeah.
But then, so Annabeth is now put in a position where she has to use the pearl. And so one pearl used, the other two, we're not sure who's going to get it, Grover, Percy, or Sally. It's really telling the fact that she says she trusts Percy's dad and the pearl that he's given them, that she trusts him now, because we know so much of her arc has been developing a distrust for her own mother. But she trusts Percy's dad a little bit more now.
Well, she doesn't call him. She doesn't call him Poseidon. She says, "I trust your dad." It's more that she trusts Percy, and that Percy trusts his dad.
That's true. Percy trusts that it'll work, so she trusts Percy that it'll work.
Yeah,
yeah. And Percy really doesn't want to leave her, and she says, "I'll be okay" to him, which is a direct callback to Percy's "I'm okay" as he's getting turned to gold in episode 5. And that made me like that scene, the throne scene, a lot more, how they're kind of calling back to it and calling back to things that they planted in that episode, like the conversation about the movies. I wrote in my notes that I decided I love that scene, and I don't know if that's true. I think I might have been influenced by the fan edits. I think I like that it, as we go on in the show, it doesn't feel like it was just a random scene they added in to get Annabeth to have this fantastic monologue. It was themes that they're continuing to follow and things are continuing to come back to.
So Percy and Grover have to run away while Annabeth distracts Cerberus, uses the pearl to escape back into the living world. So yep. We move forward to the desert. Now, this part of the underworld is past Asphodel, getting closer to Hades' palace. This is kind of where we've seen Kronos in Percy's nightmares in the past, which is what you've said, because I had not watched a lot of the trailer or noticed anything about the underworld being like a desert. So I was really hoping that it would be the case. And I thought that was really brilliant to make it seem so vast and empty instead of being rocky to be sandy. Feels so much scarier in a lot of ways because there's nothing solid to hold on to except for Hades' palace.
That's interesting. Yeah.
They do notice that Cerberus is no longer following them. They're like, why would he follow us this far and then just give up? Like, that doesn't seem right. But they don't really have time to think because Grover can't stop walking. And then he's dragged through the sand by his shoes. So we see Tartarus, which was not what I pictured, but exactly what I pictured. Like, it made sense.
Yeah. It was definitely very ominous and overwhelming.
Yeah.
A brief glimpse of the pit.
And it's so scary to be being not only dragged, but it's sand. You have nothing to really grip onto. You're going to fall into Tartarus. And Percy recognizes it. He sees it. He hears the voice. He knows that this is where his dreams have been coming from. But he doesn't have a lot of time to think. He uses the swords as leverage to hold on. And the shoes fly so hard they rip themselves off of Grover and they go into Tartarus.
And that's back to that in the books as well. The only reason that they didn't get sucked into Tartarus right then is because Grover was wearing them. And he has a goat feet that are not meant to stay in Converse.
Yeah, and so they're able to actually fall off instead of ripping someone's foot off or bringing their entire body with them.
Yeah.
So Percy falls backwards and they hear a clunk in his backpack and they open it and they find the master bolt.
I loved this scene. It had some humor to it where Grover's like, is that? And Percy's like, no. And Grover's like, it looks like. And Percy's like, I think it is. And they're both so shocked that it's there.
And they're fully panicking because they takes them a moment to try to understand what's going on. And then they remember that Ares gave him the backpack. And also, I didn't remember that they don't have it the entire time, that it appears as they're coming close to Tartarus. Because Oris, that would have been so stupid. The way I would have immediately opened a backpack, someone gives me a gift or a bag, I'm going to tear through it and look what's inside the moment it's given to me. And so the idea that Percy had not looked at it until this moment is obviously not true. So it makes more sense that they've gotten close to Tartarus. The whole ploy was for them to be able to have it delivered by being dragged down to Kronos.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Alas, the goat feet. The foil in the plan. The flaw in the plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, they also realize that, well, they don't know about Kronos at this point. So Percy's like, Hades and Ares work together to frame me and start the war. And technically the quest is over. They should go back to Zeus, return the bolt, and they should be done. They don't even have to talk to Hades. They should just go. But Grover is the one who says, we got to save your mom. Like, Zeus can wait. There are bigger things. Which is like such an improvement on the beginning where Grover felt like he was betraying Percy. And now it's just like, oh no, Grover is 100% Percy's boy through and through.
Yeah. And this is a huge development for Grover because he's always followed the rules and been very fearful of the gods. And he's now like, nah, I don't fear the gods. I fear Percy. Like, I fear what Percy's going to do if we don't get his mom.
Well, more than that, it's been repeatedly, the only time Grover has defied the gods is for Sally. In the beginning, when he's the one who told Percy that Sally's still alive, and then he had to shovel poop because he defied the gods. And it's always been for Percy about Sally because Grover understands Percy's love for Sally.
I love that. I think that's a huge elevation, honestly, from Book Grover. And I love Book Grover, but this version of Grover is even more loyal, much braver, plays the pan flute way less.
Thank God.
All right. So then the scene switches again to another flashback of that same scene. Percy, baby Percy and Sally are at a restaurant eating ice cream. They're clearly not having a good time. They're not really talking. We learn that Sally has managed to get Percy into this school. It's their last meal together. And she's like, come on, I don't want to say goodbye like this. Like, talk to me. But he's super upset, not talking to her, clearly distraught about something.
The way he throws out, I would never do this to you. Like, he doesn't say anything but that, and it destroys Sally. And she doesn't have a response to it, because she does have a response where she's like, you are a demigod. You need to be safe. Like, that is all of it. She can't say that stuff. So she instead has to, like, go pay the bill and, like, pretend everything is okay. And it's just, like, the helplessness of that moment in the perspective, especially if Percy has a lot of regret now. I'm sure the moment he found out he was a demigod, things like this moment clicked into place for him, where he now understands his mom's motives and now is regretful at the way that he responded to it, because he was a kid and he wanted his mom, and now he understands everything she's ever done was to protect him.
Apparently not regretful enough to root him to the asphodel.
Yeah, though. Like, what is the thing that needs to root you?
What did she do? Yeah, I'm still not sure about that change. Can't really explain that one.
I would love it if the regret is that she's regretful that she now has a crush on the stupidest boy she knows.
That's my new headcanon. She regrets that she's catching feelings for this idiot.
And it's rooting her in Asphodel. Like, it's the worst thing that could possibly happen to her.
They're all just like, oh, is it because of Talia? Is it your dad? And she's like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's go with that. Good take.
All right, so they end up going to Hades Palace. It's cold and rocky and really empty. It's not grand.
Where's Persephone's garden?
I know.
I feel like it's missing her touch, her flair. I guess it is summer, so she's not there. Ooh. I wonder if, like, it changes in the winter and becomes, like, vibrant. There's parties. She really, like, brings the fun to the underworld. And then Hades in the summer, brooding. He's just there by himself. All her decorations are gone.
He can't be reminded of his wife who's on her vacation.
Yeah, yeah.
Her work trip, actually.
Her work trip. She has to go on a work trip.
Also, the way that Hades introduces himself, and he's just like, he's like, walks up to them. It's such a far walk. He's not sitting in his throne. He's not doing a whole show. He walks up to them. He's so, like, comical. He's very casual. He's just, like, in, like, an outfit. Whereas in the book, he's, like, wearing a gown or a cloak made out of the souls of the dead. They're all screaming and, like, this one, he's just some dude. He's just some guy.
He, like, immediately tries to make a nautical pun for Percy, and Percy's having none of it. I actually liked how awkward Hades is, mostly because I kept imagining this version of Hades interacting with Nico, and him being bad at parenting simply because he's awkward and keeps making puns, and Nico's like, please stop.
My sister is dead. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, I thought of another nautical pun to say to Percy. I did also have a note that I like that the gods overall have been coming across more friendly, even though we know they're not by their actions, but from Hermes, Hephaestus, not really Ares. Ares just kind of seems like an idiot. And now Hades, they're coming across a lot more friendly, but we know that they suck. And I think it speaks to this theme that I keep coming back to of who's a monster and who isn't. Like, these gods look like humans, act like humans, but they're not humans. And they're not as nice as they may appear sometimes. They can be very mean.
I also think it's this interesting idea of Monsters don't have empathy. They don't understand how humans think and so and feel. And therefore, when they cause pain, it feels less cruel than someone who understands what it is to be human, have human emotions, and then goes and out of their way to be hurtful. So you have these gods who like understand how hard it is to be a parent, understand that they can't care for their kids and their kids suffer, and by bringing their kids into the world, their kids will suffer and die, and they continue to have children.
Yeah, like they empathize, or more so sympathize with the humans, but they don't change their actions. Fun.
Love it.
Love to see that. Well, Hades then takes Grover and Percy back to his, like, I guess, sitting room, living room area. I don't know. It's all like empty.
It's like the entire castle is empty. And there's this, like, one small corner where there's a rug and a sofa and then the gold statue of Sally.
It's honestly really funny. And it really is giving Nico to me. I feel like Nico would do that. Like, Nico thinks he's like, oh, I have this darkness to me. And then he just, like, would have a room with a couch in it that's kind of dorky. Yeah, Hades really needs Persephone there for the interior decorating.
True. He eats his cereal out of a frisbee. You know, the thing boys do.
Yes. He's like a bachelor right now. So he does have Sally as a golden statue, which is neat because Percy was just a golden statue a few episodes ago. So it's a family thing they're doing now.
So Hades is like, okay, let's make our trade. Like, let's do our thing. And this is Percy's opportunity to monologue. But what is right and what is wrong? And he's like, it's wrong of you to want the bolt. It's wrong of you to have stolen it and framed me. I'm not going to let you do it. I know about your plan. And Hades is like, what the fuck are you talking about?
We loved that. So funny.
He's like, what? And so he tells him he actually doesn't want the Master Bolt. He's happy in his palace. He doesn't want a war with his brothers. He's like, my brothers hold grudges. I don't, which is hilarious. Because we know the children of Hades' fatal flaw is holding grudges.
Yeah.
But this version of Hades seems really, like, not confrontational and doesn't seem to care. It matches the book of Hades is like, I don't want any more subjects in my kingdom. We're already so overfilled that I don't need anymore. I'm not trying to make my kingdom stronger. Like, no matter what happens, his kingdom will always be the strongest because people will always die. Yeah. And so I liked that was there, but this not holding a grudge, my brothers, that's my brother's problem, not my problem, was a very interesting take on this version of Hades. So the other version of Hades was looking for a way to just one-up his brothers at all times.
Very true. He's just like, maybe he's just not self-aware. That's what I'm gonna go
That's
with.
Fun, yeah.
But he accuses them. He's like, no, God, just give me my helm back. And they're like, you're what? And he's like, you guys took my helm of darkness so that you could steal the Master Bolt and become invisible, which is kind of funny because it's like, Annabeth has her hat. Like, she could, like, what? And Percy has a moment where he's like, okay, we're clearly all not talking about the same thing. And he starts connecting dots in his brain. And we watch on his face as he realizes that it is Kronos that has been haunting his dreams and has probably orchestrated this whole thing.
So after Percy explains his thought process that it's Kronos, Hades does a 180. He wants the bolt. He's like, Percy, if you want, I will give you sanctuary to you and the goat and to Sally.
The goat.
And he wants to be properly armed. If Kronos is out there, he wants to protect his kingdom and his people, which is the whole point, is that the gods are super divided. And here we see a great example of that. Hades is not like, oh, I have to go tell my brothers we have to get ready for war. He's like, I've got to protect my own. And so I'm going to use my brother's bolt, which will make him defenseless so that I could protect myself.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And to that, Percy's like, no, I'm going to go return. I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to go tell Zeus about what's happening and stop Kronos from destroying the world. He says to Hades, he's like, I'll take you up on your trade. And Hades is like, great, give me the bolt. And then Percy's like, no, your first trade, I'm going to go and get the helm for you and then come back and get my mom. And he tells his mom's statue to hold fast, which, oh, right in the gut, and Perfect. Speaks so much to the fact that Percy is such a good person and he makes these choices because he knows they're the right thing to do. Even though we know all he wants is to have his mom back and to keep her safe and to not have anything to do with this war, honestly, but he knows it's the right thing to do. So him and Grover use their pearls, leave Sally in the underworld, and they vanish back to the living world.
So we get a flashback to Sally and Poseidon. So Sally is having her little cry back at the bar. She lights a match and puts it out in a used ice cream cup. And I was like, what is this? Is this a signal? And you have clearly said it's an offering, and that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
I love the fact that all these kids at camp give daily offerings from every meal and get nothing. And Sally does it once and Poseidon is immediately like, I'm there. I'm showing up.
Like, not even a moment. Like, the moment she does it, we hear the oceans, like, waves crashing, clouds come, Poseidon is there, and he joins her at the bar.
He's whipped. Honestly, though, like, I get it. I, too, if Sally called for me, I would be like, I'm there. I'm going to help you with whatever you need, ma'am.
Sally tells him it's not fair. She's failing. She can't keep Percy with her, and she wants to take him to camp where he's going to be safe because monsters are showing up in Percy's life. So Poseidon makes her talk out why she doesn't want to do this. He doesn't tell her what to do. He's a very hands-off dad. It's funny because in this moment, they seem like really good partners, but he's making her do all the work. He's just being her therapist in the moment.
He's not even a good therapist.
No. He's just like, tell me, even if it's horrible to say, talk it out loud. Let's figure out what you're going to do. And she doesn't want to take him to camp because she wants Percy to develop his own morals and personality, because she knows the moment the Olympians get their hands on him, they're going to turn him into a weapon or whatever they want him to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I thought this was a great addition and development on the original books, because that was something I always wondered, like with Percy constantly being in peril and getting kicked out of schools, why she didn't send him to camp earlier, other than her just wanting to spend more time with him. And so I think this is a great addition, that it was because she wanted him to develop on his own outside of being a child of the gods and outside of what the gods wanted him to become.
Well, she also knows he's a forbidden child, so she knew that there was going to be a lot of repercussions when she sends Percy to camp, and so he needs to be truly ready before he goes to camp.
Mm-hmm.
Poseidon tells her that she's answered her own question. I was like, yeah, whatever. Good job on the help, Poseidon. Doesn't even pay child support. Okay, he's going to school. No. Percy's going to go to school. It's going to be torturous for both of them, but he's going to be stronger for it. And he's like, his mother raised him well. She did. All by herself, may I add.
Yeah, not thanks to you, Poseidon.
Sally asks Poseidon if he wants to talk to him. And he's like, one day, like, I'll talk to him. And this is where we get
yourself
braced. That's all he's going to do. Well, that's...
I do need to interject and say that I think Poseidon's the hottest god so far.
Really?
Of everyone they've cast? Yeah. Wait, who do you think's the hottest god so far? Mr. D?
I guess, I mean, I think Ares is hotter in a... Really? I mean, I don't think any of them are that hot, not gonna lie, compared to what I thought. Poseidon is attractive. I think he and Sally make...
Accent.
He does. I don't like his teeth. Sorry. It's very specific. I know. It's very specific.
I didn't notice some.
I noticed them the second time I watched the episode. So
amazing.
I like that he and Sally look like a really hot couple. Like they look like damn. Yeah. And I liked his accent, but not every it was you know, we'll see. I think they could do. Yeah. Obviously, Lin-Manuel Miranda is not a top hot god, but I thought Ares is pretty hot.
Hermes has the most children.
But he's charming.
He's charming.
Mm-hmm. Probably wrote them a song.
He rapped at them.
Yeah. I mean, Hermes himself, it's like he can travel between time and space. Like, he just confuses his partner and has children with them.
Yeah.
So the voice over of Poseidon continues, as Percy wakes up with Annabeth, now like current Percy, mm-hmm. having come to the living world, wakes up with Annabeth and Grover on the Santa Monica shore and talking about like, I'll help Percy one day and when he's ready. And I mm-hmm. loved it. I loved it so much.
I was really into this specific shot because for a millisecond, I thought as Percy's waking up and you see feet walking towards him, for a very short second, I was like, is that Poseidon? Are they inserting him here? And then I'm like, that's a child and it's Annabeth who was there. But I thought it was really interesting to juxtapose Poseidon promising to help Percy with Annabeth actually being there, being the one who's actually helping him up, and Grover's also there. And these are the ones who are actually there and actually helping him besides Sally. And yet the gods continue to promise to one day help.
And their help is very godly. Like, they never become uh-huh. a parent. Their help is like, I have blessed you. I bring you some rain. I've let the ocean carry you this way. It's never an actual yeah. parent moment of like, let's check in with your emotions. Let me like fight your battles for you. It's
yeah.
I'm going to give you some tools, but never show you affection or appreciation.
Yeah. And I'm going to give you tools in the form of a riddle also. They love riddles.
They love riddles. We see Ares standing there. He's drawn his sword and Percy does too. Mm. So we know that there's going to be some conflict. And we know there's that Walker has talked about it quite a bit. So it's going to be good.
Yeah, Walker's favorite scene is coming. So imagine Grover in the background being like, fight, fight, fight.
That's honestly how I imagine it going.
We would do if we were there.
Popcorn would suddenly appear. I'd have a glass of wine.
Oh, yeah.
I'd be shouting just the stupidest suggestions. Yeah. I'd throw a chair in there. He's a WWE fighter. Let's get it going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. So I loved this episode. I thought it was really good. I think it tied together everything. I think that the problem is, and you and I have talked about this, Disney should not have released this as like episode by episode. Either they should have yep. released it two chunks, the first half and the second half.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Or they should have released it all together. These episodes are too short. They work better together when you can binge watch it. It doesn't make any sense. It makes you sit there and think, be more confused rather than being able to see how well everything is tied together.
Yeah, it makes you like pick apart the things we got because the episodes are quite short and only watch it. If you only watch one a week, like you're going to see everything and you're going to overanalyze it. Yeah, I agree. I strongly think that shows that are less than an hour episode should just be all released at once on streaming. Gone are the days of cable television.
Yeah.
If it's short, release it all at once.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense.
I'd find a way to week between an hour because I need more time to process an hour-long episode. But when they're 30 minutes or 40 minutes, and these are really fast-paced episodes and that there's a lot of content that happens in each, I think that the viewing experience is better. I mean, for us, with the screeners being able to watch them, the experience has been better being able to watch them back to back. And I think that the show, upon rewatch for people, hopefully, after they've seen all the episodes and then can binge the whole thing, I think they work really well back to back, like a long movie.
Yeah, exactly. And I would suggest for everybody, once this is wrapped up, to go back and just binge through it once. Feel the proper pacing of the show mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. it makes a lot more sense then.
I agree. Yeah.
All right. Are you ready to do some lightning bolt questions?
I don't know. Am I? Sure.
All right. So our rewind question is from episode 8 and it was, what would your ultimate field of punishment be?
Oh, okay. You know, I feel like a answer to this is to think of my recurring nightmares. And I have like two recurring nightmares. One is being on a roller coaster that breaks, but I don't know that that would be a punishment thing because that's a fact. That ends fast, you know, like constantly breaking. Another one is where I'm packing for a trip and I can't fit everything.
So
you can could take that one and really run with it. Like, I'm late for my flight. I'm constantly late. Maybe there's, I get stuck in traffic. I think being in perpetual back-to-back traffic would be a really good form of punishment.
I guess it depends on the punishment itself. Like, if this person has murdered
That's
multiple
true.
People, and like,
probably
stuck in
more.
Traffic.
Yeah, I probably need more than that. But just, like, if it's for being an annoying person.
All right, so perpetual traffic, not being able to fit everything in your suitcase. All right. Well, mine was, I experienced a version of this. I went and stayed at an Airbnb this weekend that was a farm. It was my bad. I should have known
better. A farm is your punishment?
No, as I was sleeping, there was something that was hitting against the wall inconsistently. Like, loudly, and so I'd start drifting off to sleep, and some, like, I would do an alarm or a sound that goes off inconsistently, because if it's consistently, you can kind of sleep through it, and your body starts expecting it as a pattern. Something off pattern that suddenly goes off, so you can never fully enter REM sleep, and so you're just perpetually exhausted and chasing asleep. You're about to get drowsy, you're about to fall asleep, you're getting cozy, then something disturbs you while you're trying to sleep forever.
Yeah, that sounds awful.
Yeah, I was very tired. I came back home and slept for like 15 hours.
That's good.
All right, let me play whatever we talked about. It's not as long as some of our, it's actually pretty long.
Okay, good. I'm so glad. I'm sure it's my fault.
What would your personalized ultimate fields of punishment be? Like, if they designed a punishment or basically like a level of hell just for you, what is it?
So if it's like really boring and boring in the sense of like, okay, this is what most people's punishment would be. It would be like obviously seeing the people that I love die or get hurt. But if we're going to be creative about it, I think it would be just me opening up my computer to check my final grades and seeing that I got like a 40% on everything. And then also finding out that I failed a bunch of my classes because I didn't even know that I was taking. This is a reoccurring nightmare, by the way, that because I forgot that I had ever taken them. And I thought that I had done really well and had been expecting to do well. And just me opening and getting that sinking feeling every single and feeling of disappointment every single time.
Oof.
Yeah.
Wow. For eternity.
Creative. Yeah, I had a dream about this very, very recently, so it's, like, fresh in my mind.
You're like, it's right there.
Yeah, and it was, like, not a good feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about you?
Mine, I've thought about this before. My very specific punishment would be that I'm on a plane, and the plane is full of, like, people I know and, like, people that are, like, authority figures, like teachers and bosses and people I'm trying to impress. And I'm sick on the plane. And I keep throwing up, but I don't ever feel better after throwing up. Because it's, like, such a weird punishment.
Very specific.
I've combined a bunch of my, like, nightmare things. So, one, disappointing people and failing them. Two, planes. Three, being sick on said plane. I have a very specific phobia of throwing up on a plane. And I've met other people who have this. I will truly, like, the night before a trip, I will be like, oh, I can't eat this piece of pie because what if I get food poisoning? It's like, it's such weird leaps my mind goes through. And on the plane, I'll be just like, to have my Tums and my, like, anxiety meds, and I'm like, I'm good. But that would be my specific thing, is I'm stuck on this plane, I keep throwing up, but I never feel better, and everyone is like, wow, you've failed, you threw up.
All right, so you've moved on from throwing up on a plane to not being able to pack a suitcase.
I still am very afraid of throwing up on a plane.
Yes.
That is still a fear that I have, and I do travel with Tums.
I will say, I graduated in June, and I have not had a dream about... since I fully graduated, got my diploma in my hands, I have not had any kind of... Totally forgot that failing grades was something I cared about. So it does get better, people. Just finish school forever.
Yeah, and then you never have to worry about a grade again.
I know. Mm-hmm. You can tell I was in the thick of it, so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you ready for the next question?
No.
All right. If you were to, I'm so excited for you to post this on Instagram. I'm so sorry. If you were to die tomorrow, do you think you'd end up being rooted in Asphodel?
I just wrote what the fuck on the outline. I saw this when I did my notes, and I was immediately like, Manasa, go back to like, what is your fatal flaw question? So I've been thinking about this and the concept of regret. And I think that I have a lot of lowercase r regrets. I think that's very normal. I feel like I used to think I had no regrets, but I was mostly just thinking of like capital R regrets, like big things where it's like, oh, I ruined someone's life or I ruined my own life. But I have a lot of little what ifs of like, oh, I wonder what would happen if I majored in this or if I'd taken this job, blah, blah, blah. I hope I wouldn't be rooted by any of those, but it really depends on the day.
True.
Because there are some days where I'm like really ruminating on a particular choice or decision and really paralyzed by it. But I don't know, does Asphodel like care about my particular thought patterns, or is it
what it decides?
What does it decide?
Yeah.
I don't think I have any like big things that like if I was on a deathbed that I would be like, wow, I really fucked that up. I wish I had apologized or changed that. Everything happens for a reason.
The reason is me, because I did it.
The reason is my decisions, yeah.
I was thinking about it too, because I was like, okay, I feel like everyone, especially if you die suddenly, would have a regret of like not being able to continue being alive and then do the things, right? True. That's a big regret. And then there's like the things that I would have done in the future if my timeline had allowed me to do so, like get married, have kids, buy a house, do the things that I wanted to do in that way, travel in the way that I wanted to do. And a lot of people are like, I don't have regrets, do it now. But like that wouldn't be like a big R regret. Those are things that I would have wished would happen. But if I died in this moment, and the regret of like hurting my family by being dead, that's not like...
How dare you?
Yeah, that's not something I could ever change, no matter when I die. So I don't think I would end up being rooted. Again, I don't have any deathbed confessions or things that I have to get done. There was obviously, if I was told I'm going to die tomorrow, there are things that I would then try to do in that span of time. But
that's God, more... That thought overwhelms me.
Right? Like, there's more of like... It's too much. That's like that's not a big R regret. I have no one I need to go find and apologize, make amends to, knock on wood, that I can remember at this moment. Nothing is crippling me. There's like things, like small things, like you said, like if I had done this, if I had done this better, if I had taken a break, if I had a lot of stuff like that. But yeah, I think that's why I'm obsessed with whatever is rooted Annabeth.
Yeah. What did she do?
What did she do?
Because if it's Talia, why isn't Grover rooted? And if it's, I mean, Annabeth had a deeper relationship with Talia, but I'm so curious. Yeah. All right. Well, that fun question. I have a more lighthearted one. What would be the first movie that you would show Annabeth after the quest?
Oh my God. Especially this Annabeth, who's like never had a childhood. And this is like, I would show her Sharknado.
Seen Sharknado?
I've seen parts of it. It's not good enough to like personally sit through, but it is fun idea of like this extremely logical person who's never seen a movie, in the first movie that she's ever seen is Sharknado.
I feel like Percy would choose to show her that.
He'd like, this is an excellent film.
I was thinking like Shrek.
Yeah, that's a good one too.
It's fun for all ages, you know? And then she could understand the memes and the cultural significance of Shrek.
Or even like the Lion King, and just absolutely devastate her and her daddy issues.
I think she'd like the Lion King.
You think she'd like it? Oh yeah, eventually. I think she'd be really upset for the Mufasa part, because she has deep-rooted daddy issues too.
Yeah. She likes dogs. She might like a dog movie. Homeward Bound.
Old Yeller.
Oh my God. Where the red fern grows.
Yeah, yeah.
We're actually like doing it yeah. enough now.
We fully got into older sibling mode and we're like, what would yeah. be ruin her day, actually?
What would actually traumatize her against movies forever? Alrighty. Well, that's our show.
That is our show.
Next week, we will be talking about episode 8, which is the finale, the final episode of the TV show. So we're excited to chat about that with you all.
If you join our Patreon, you get to read our old outlines. They're pretty fun. They're kind of wacky. And it's a great way to remember the book without having to do all that work yourself. It's only $3 a month yeah. to see them.
Indeed. And the link to send us an audio message is in the episode description as well. We're hoping to have some kind of like wrap-up episode after our next one. And so if you have an audio message that you want in there, send that soon.
Don't forget to rate and review if you haven't already, which is an insane thing. But rate and review us where you listen to your podcast.
Alrighty. Bye.
Bye-bye.